Bible School here on James Canyon. We're given the history, really, of how the Christadelphian doctrine was brought to this country and who brought it here, and also a little bit of history probably about the area and about the trip that the pioneers made when they came to this country. Seems like if you were going to start something like that, a good way to start it would be like God said, in the beginning God saw fit to sow the seed of the truth in Texas, and I don't know for sure where it come from into Texas, but anyway, our folks were down in Texas, and that was in 1887. And in the late spring or early summer of that year, times were hard down in that part of the country at that time, and lots of people around, and the cattle were all pretty well overgrazing the land that was around there. And it was down around Fredericksburg and High, right in there where the old meeting grounds are still, and where they still have the Texas Bible School in that part of the country. And our folks were the Walkers, the Campbells, and the Poseys that all lived there at that time. And they had already learned the truth from a fellow whose name was Haley. And again, I don't know where he learned it, but they told us a little bit about this Brother Haley. And he came on to this part of the country later on. And if I don't forget it, Henry, I'll tell you a little story about him. They said that he had lost one arm, and that he was a big man, but even with that one arm gone, why, he would always preach, and said when he would preach, children would be sitting around on benches over in this meeting place where they were, in a little old house that they had built for a schoolhouse and also for a place to meet and have their Sunday worship, and also sometimes they would have some preaching. Said Brother Haley would preach anyway 2 hours, and said he would say, "Now I'll quote you the scripture." Said, "Now wait, that scripture has left me." Said, "I'll have to turn to it and read it." Said, "You'll have to bear with me. I've only got one hand." Said he'd lay his Bible down and he'd lick his thumb and turn through the pages, and "Yes, here it is now." And then he would read the scripture, whatever it was. And he was the one that taught, anyway, my grandfather, John Walker, the truth of the Bible. And he was a Baptist at that time. And down in Texas, the custom was you could either work on the road so much each year, or you could pay so much taxes to the county. So they were all out doing their road work, of course, and they were sitting down there one day having lunch and a little siesta probably. They didn't go into that. But anyway, this old Brother Haley told my granddad, he said, "John, did you know that God made some promises to man that he never did fulfill?" My granddad was a young man. He said, "No, I didn't." Said, "God has done everything he ever said he would do." Said, "I didn't know that." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what." Said, "He made some promises to Abraham there and to his seed. He said, you can just read it for yourself." And said, "You'll see that there's some promises there that God made that he never has fulfilled." And said, "That's what we as Christadelphians believe, and that's what we're looking for, is for these promises to be fulfilled." My granddad said, "You know, I went studying on that," and said, "That's the spark that was the thing that taught me the truth." So they all had learned it there from that little source, and as they all had gotten together with their Texas Longhorn cattle and what little bit of stuff that they could bring with them from Texas into this country to sort of save the bare necessities that they could carry in their covered wagons, and they had started really for the Oregon Territory. They'd heard about that country up there, and so they started early enough in the year. They thought they had time to drive their cattle a few miles each day and go clear on up into the Oregon Territory and settle up in there. So when they got ready to go, there was a young brother that this brother Campbell, his name was Joe Campbell, and by the way, that happens to be the one that Joe Boma named after. That was some of his mother's ancestors, great-grandpa or something like that on down the line. I can remember him real well, and when I was a kid, I remember how loud he'd open his mouth when he'd sing. And he would really rear back and bear down on it. He was a good singer, and I'd sit there, you know, and look at him, and he sure would sing them loud. Anyway, he had gone with this Brother Haley's daughter, and she was a young, pretty girl, and they had been wanting to get married, but Brother Haley said she was too young, and he was real strict on his children, so that was a no-no. So they decided when they started out that she'd sneak out the window and go with them, and that they would get married anyway, whether he wanted them to or not. So sure enough, she sneaked out, and they started on their way. And so the next day he missed her and said, "Where is she?" And they said, "Well, she's eloped and gone on with Joe Campbell." And he said, "Well, I'm going to catch up with them, and I'm going to stop it." So the next day he caught up with them, and he'd had time to think about it a couple of days. And when he got there, he said, "Well, I wish you well. Go on." So they came on. Seems along the way that they run into lots of obstacles, and they made it pretty good at first. Said things went along pretty good, and of course they all had hoped and prayed that everything would go good and none of them would die on the way. And one thing I've never told yet is that my grandmother had an old, I believe it's a Singer sewing machine, one of these old foot pedal sewing machines, and we still have that. My sister has that, and she brought that from Texas with her all the way, and it still sews. So that's a plug for the sewing machine company. They'd have their worship every Sunday as they would go along. Well, they'd stop their wagons and get out in the dust, and the men would all remove their hats, and they would gather around and have a few words before worship, and then they would all have the breaking of bread. And at that time, they said they only knew three hymns, and I know they said one of them was "Come Thou Long Expected Jesus." They would sing that one. And that was something that made an impression on me in the modern times about how people sometimes will make excuses to not go and have worship each Sunday. But to see how difficult it was for them, you know, to stop their herd and to stop their wagons and gather around and have their worship each Sunday showed that they did really have faith in what they were doing and trust in God. And it so happened that none of them didn't die on the way, and they all made it good. And I believe Brother Ed Posey had five children, and John Walker, my granddad, I believe, had three. And I believe Charlie Walker had one, maybe Willie Walker. And I'm not sure about that, how many he had. But anyway, all of the children that they had, they would each one ride in the different wagons, and then sometimes they would get permission, you know, from one to ride in their wagon. They liked some other children better. And they made a deal when they started that any of the adults could correct any of the kids and even give them a spanking if they needed it. And they really got along well. And I just doubt if you could get three families together like that now with that many kids and put them all that much confined and get along as well as they did, each one correcting the other's children and things like that. But they really stuck together and were a real tight group of people, and they never did have a family falling out like a lot of the early pioneers did sometimes when they would be in close contact that way and try to get along, and directly someone would throw a temper fit, if you will, and another one would take him up on it, and they'd have a split, and the families would be old grudges and things like that. So Our folks never was guilty of that. And they came on, and when they got to the Pecos River, they had told them that for a couple of days here, you're going to have to drive your herd on, and there won't be any water. You'll have to carry enough water on your wagons to camp on and for your teams, but said there's no way your animals, your cattle, can have any water, so you'll have to really try to handle it as best you can in this hot weather. And if you could imagine when you're driving along in your air-conditioned cars going back to Texas or through Texas, how it would be out there in a covered wagon, not knowing for sure where you were going, have to go ahead and scout out the way and go like that. And the weather conditions, both heat and rain and wind and all of that, you can see the hardships of the pioneer families. So they filled their little wooden kegs with water and got all set for the 2 days' journey to drive without water along till they came to the Pecos River. So when the way the road or the trail that they was on, and it was just two wagon ruts, they said, it kind of paralleled the Pecos River out a few miles from it, and then there was a certain place up here a little farther that they could cross their cattle. But along the banks of the river, it was at flood stage at that time. They'd had some heavy rains on up in the mountains on up in the head of the Pecos, and it was really rolling with muddy water, they said. And well, they were driving their cattle along, and they'd driven them about a day and a night, and the next day they were driving them along, and it come up a stiff west wind. Had those old Texas longhorns stuck up their noses and begin to sniff and said they could smell that water. And they begin to bawl right low, and each one sort of seemed to know what that meant. And they would moo to each other, you know, and said directly they just stuck their heads up into that wind and struck a long team trot right straight for the Pecos. And the cowboys all got ahead of them and said they'd just run around them like flies, and they just went right on toward the Pecos River and said they all they could do was just follow along behind and see what happened. So when they got to the river, said there was a low bank there, and the water had gotten up so that it, just a pretty low bank there, that those cows, every one, would just dive right off into that muddy water, and said the last thing that'd go out of sight would be their tail when they'd disappear. And then they'd come up out there a little ways, a slurping that muddy water, drinking. And they thought, well, they'll wash away, or maybe we'll lose half of our cattle or whatever. But said they all just swam around out there and circled around, and the bank was low enough that they could climb up, and they came back on the same side that they were on. That is, all except one old bull, and he crossed on out on the other side. So said, well, should we let him go, or should we try to get him? And his name was Old Brownlow. I remember that. You know, kids remember things. So said, Brother Ed Posey, said, you're the best swimmer among us. Said, why don't you swim over there and drive him back across? So said, okay. So said, he shucked his shirt off and said they could remember how his bare back would shine when he was swimming out the breaststroke out across that Pecos River to get that old bull. And he got around him, drove him back, and they got every one of them back on that side, drove them on up to the crossing. And when they started to go across, then there was a couple of cowboys come riding up, and they said, well, you better introduce yourselves. Said, we're men from the U.S. Health Bureau, and said, your cattle are under quarantine. Said, you can't cross the Pecos River until it frosts because your cattle have ticks on them. And said, that'll spread the ticks on up into the other country. And I imagine, instead of what I know about cattle in this day and time, they was afraid those ticks would carry that disease, the hoof and mouth disease that we call it now, and bring it on into this country as ticks and lice like that carry that disease. So they didn't have any choice but just to stop their herd. And they was camped there then 3 months, just loose herding their cattle around there wherever they could find food for them. along the Pecos River, and they had saved up some money, but they said, we're liable to spend a lot of our nest egg here while we're just sitting here waiting to go on with our cattle. So some of the men said, well, we'll go back down into some of the farm country on back down in there, maybe even back down home and work and make enough to kind of keep our nest egg going. So some of the men folks did go back and work, and some of the ladies then, they stayed there and helped loose herd the cattle around there, and said that they roped up some of those old Texas Longhorn cows and would milk them and have fresh milk and cream. And my grandmother even made some butter and put it down in an old wooden keg and said, now we'll have this butter to go on our trip. And my dad said, I can still remember how strong that old keggy butter was. Said everything they'd cook, they'd season with that old butter, and said, it just ruined it for me. Said it sure was rank. But anyway, that's the way the story went, that they were camped along there, and they'd fish, catch a few fish out of the river there. And story goes, they just killed one antelope on the whole road coming here, and they had an old rifle. Any of you fellas that know anything about guns, it was an old Jocelyn rifle, and it was something like a Spencer cartridge, shot a little rim fire cartridge about that long and shot just about like 22 short for distance. But one of them sneaked up and killed an antelope with that old gun, and that's the only big game animal as such that they killed along the way. Said that when they got ready to come on with their cattle, that they men folks had all gotten back and it had frosted and they were starting on with their cattle. And while they were camped there, though, said they rolled up their beds one morning, and the bed that my dad and his granddad were sleeping under had a rattlesnake under it. And so they said that sure did give them a scare. So they were really watching for snakes from then on. And when they crossed the Pecos River and started on up, still aiming to go on into the Oregon Territory, and looks like that they would have had more sense than that to me that late in the year to think that they could cross the mountain ranges between there and Oregon and with those cattle and make that drive. So I guess that's what they were thinking too, because there was a man living on 16 Springs then whose name was Hanson, and he built the old house that is right across from my house where those deep freezes were, you that went on the hike, the old log house there. Was the one that he was living in then, and some of his cattle, there were no fences and open range, and the cattle would go up in the high country in the summertime, then they'd drift back out in the flat part in the lower ranges in the wintertime. And it was late enough in the year that Mr. Hanson was down there seeing about some of his cattle, and he saw our folks and their covered wagons there and their cattle, and he rode over to their wagon. And by the way, he had a leg off right here that he'd lost in the Civil War, right in that hip joint. And said when he got shot in the knee, and said he saw the joint water in his knee run out on the ground, and he said, I thought, now, my knee will be stiff the rest of my life. And he got blood poison in that, and they cut his leg off right above the knee, and they didn't get it far enough, so then they had to take it off right in the hip joint. And he weighed over 200 pounds without that leg, and said he'd always carry a crutch on his saddle, and he'd sit crossways kind of on his horse. And every one of his horses is sore backed because of the way he'd sit in the saddle. So he told our folks, said, if you will come up in that country and settle, said, that's just paradise on earth. Said, there's room there for all of you and lots of grass. And said, with your children and my children, said, we could hire a teacher and have school. And said, that I'd like for you to go look at it. So some of the men folks rode on ahead and came up in that part of the country and looked it over and said, my, the grama grass was just headed out waving in the breeze, and it never had snowed, and big old ponderosa pines all around. And said they, after all that heat and everything down in that part of the country, said they went back and told the ladies about it, and they said, let's go. So They started around, and the way they had to go, they came around what's in the Indian Reservation now over here in Elk Canyon and up the ridge and up a canyon now we call Poison Spring. And it isn't a Poison Spring as such, but two fellas camped there one time, and they gathered some wild greens and ate them, and one of them, I expect there's some wild parsnip growing there. And said one of them ate the greens and the other one didn't, and I'm just pretty sure that that wild parsnip is what killed that man. Anyway, they named it Poison Spring. They drove their cattle on up the head of the canyon, and right on top of the ridge, they stopped for lunch, and there was an old fir tree there that they ate their lunch under. And that old fir tree is still standing there. And my grandmother told me, 25 years ago, that that tree looks now just like it did then. It's not a real big tree, but you can tell it's old, and now it's dead in the top, and another 2 or 3 years it'll be dead all the way. And when you get old enough to see a tree live and die, then that's telling you something. I've seen a few. So that old tree, though, is really a landmark to me, and it's on forest land, and when they logged the country, I thought, I hope they don't cut that old tree. And they didn't, so I didn't tell them anything. It's still standing there anyway. Real steep coming off into the head of 16 Springs, and their wagons didn't have good brakes on them, so they cut some green pine trees and tied on behind their wagons with the boughs still on them, so as they'd come off down the hill, the wagons wouldn't run onto the horses and they'd have a runaway, so they came on into 16 Springs, and they camped right there pretty close to where my sister lives now, right where 16 Springs begins to fork out. My grandmother said, if we settle here, said right up on that little knoll there, it'd be a good place for our cemetery. Said it's out of the flood range, and that would be a real good place to have it. 3 years later, she had a little baby that died, and it was about 3 months old, and it was the first grave there. Said they had it in a little wooden box and hauled it up there in a wagon and had a service there and dug a grave and no fence or anything and drove off and left it and said it was sure sad like that. Said that they really, the first one like that and everything, it was really a sad little funeral. We still have the cemetery there, and a lot of my folks and a lot of other local people of 16 Springs are buried there. I told Brother Ed Posey, said, you've got the most children, said the biggest family, you can have the pick of the homesteads. Then you could file on, they called it, or homestead 160 acres. And you'd have to live on it, I think it was 2 years, and what they call prove up on it. In other words, you had to clear it out and do some farming, build a house on it, and live on it. You had to live on it. Then after that, you'd go back into the courthouse, and you'd tell them that, okay, I have lived on that, and I have proved up on it, they would call it. And then they would issue them a U.S. patent to that land. It was handled through the U.S. Patent Office. Why it was handled through the patent office, I don't know, but that's the way it is. And we have the original patent that my dad got the place where we live, where our home is now. And the president's signature is on that patent that we have. And I don't remember for sure now which president it was, but we have that in our bank box. And then if you so chose, after you got that patent, that was just like a deed, then you could sell the land, whatever you wanted to do. And a lot of people would live on the land and homestead it that way. And then they would sell it to another fella. And then they would go homestead another spot and prove up on it. And they would just kind of make a living that way, And so then one would buy out another one, and so that's the way that they would gain land like that in those days. So they all tried to get the best part of the land first, and especially where there was water, because water's pretty scarce in this part of the country, so they would all try to homestead a place if they could where there was water. So Brother Posey homesteaded the place right up there on your hike where the old log cabin was, and the Poseys built that house and raised their family there, and Sister Maud Parker is buried up here, said that she was living there, and she was a young, pretty teenage girl, and a young cowboy working over on the Indian reservation for one of the large cattle companies named Will Parker. He'd kind of taken a shine to her, and he decided he'd come over there and see her one time. So he rode his horse all the way across the mountain over there, and when he got there, said those girls were sitting out on the porch there when he rode by, and said Maud was sitting there, and said, and I looked at her, said, well, I said, I just couldn't force myself to stop, said, I just rode on and just rode on, said, I just too bashful to stop and go up there and talk to her. But something must have happened somewhere or other, because they finally got married, and they're both buried right up here in this cemetery, Will and Maud Parker. And that's Brother Elise Parker's mother and father. So the Poseys homesteaded that one, and the Campbells homesteaded the one right on down farther on below where the old Bible school grounds are, on down where the canyon forks out again in what we call Board Tree Canyon. My grandfather homesteaded right on down just a little farther in another canyon there that didn't have a name then, so they named it after him, Walker Canyon. He lived there in the mouth of that canyon, and they all homesteaded there, and there was a couple or three homesteads already there, the Hansons, and there was a lady they called Bronco Sue, and she was a pretty tough customer. She lived there where my sister lives now, had two grown boys, and I better not say too much about her, because I don't know anything except what the folks told me about her, but they said she was tough as a boot. She wore a pistol, and she was just as tough as she looked. Said there was a cowboy come by there one time, and his horse gave out and said, could I stay all night? And she said, yeah, I guess so. Said, put your horse out there in the barn. Said he turned his horse loose and went to the house, and she said, come up here, I want to show you something. Said, boy, said, every step I took, said, I wondered what it's going to be. Said, went up there, and said, she took me up there behind the barn to a big old oak stump, and said, see that stump? Said, yeah. Said, see those bullet holes in it? Said, yes, ma'am. Said, well, the last cowboy that come by here got kind of fresh with me and said he hid behind that stump. So he said, from that time on, I said, yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. And the next morning when my horse rested, I went on. Several stories I could tell about her. It wouldn't do any good, but they said, when she sold out, that there was a doctor that bought her cattle, and he bought them range delivery, we called it. They didn't round them all up and put them in a corral and count them out, tally them, we call it, and say, okay, I'll buy this 100 head of cattle for you and give you X amount for them. But she said, well, we'll just ride down the canyons and the cattle have my brand on them and we'll count them, and you pay for the ones we count, okay? And he said, fair enough to me. He said, that's a deal's a deal. So she said, good enough. So they'd ride down one canyon and count the cattle, and while they were going on down then to start up the other one, the boys would round up the cattle, drive them over the ridge, and they'd be in the other canyon over there. Directly that doctor said, you sure have a lot of these old black bobtail cows, don't you? So he finally bought the cattle for whatever amount, and bought the place from her, and she left, and I don't know what ever happened to her. But there was a fellow that lived right down on farther down named Jake Snover, and he had a wife and a daughter there then. And the second night that our folks camped there, they went on down in the mouth of Board Tree there and said that when those old Texas Longhorn cattle had laid down, you could just see their horns sticking up out of that long grass. And said they were just as full and contented as they could be, and the weather was just as nice as it could be, and it was the 8th of December. Said the next morning they got up and the snow was right up to the hubs of their wagons, and it was just about zero. And said, They had just a little bit of grub with them in their wagons, and that was it. And they told my granddad, said, maybe if you'd go up and talk to Mr. Snover, he's got some place where he'd let us move into to get out of this storm. So he said, okay. So they didn't have any overshoes or anything, but he walked about a half a mile up there where Mr. Snover lived and told him their situation and said, he sat there for a good bit and had the fire in the fireplace and said, he's spitting that fire and said, directly, he said, okay. He said, I've got an old house right across the canyon there that was just some log. Yeah, and he said it really looked like a good place to them. So he brought his mules over there and hooked onto their wagons and took them across there in that deep snow to that little old house. And there they were, the three families, all those kids and those covered wagons, and they lived right there in that little old house all winter. I asked Mr. Snover if he had any work they could do, and he said, yeah, I'll give you all the work I can. I said, what can you do? And they said, we can do whatever you've got to do. So he said, well, I'd like to do some fencing. And they'd split rails then to build fences with, cut the trees down, chop them down, split them up, and make rails and build a rail fence. You know, you've all probably seen and heard of them. So they got a job from him, $1 a rail, splitting rails, and said, if you really worked hard, you could split 100 a day. One man could split 100 a day.
So they a penny a rail.
A penny a rail, you could make $1 a day. So a penny a rail. Yeah, thank you. So they split rails like that till they decided that they'd try to work out a beef. Said he had a lot of their cattle froze to death and their cattle wasn't fat enough to butcher. And that deep snow, those old Texas Longhorn cattle didn't know enough to get up out of the main canyons and the breaks out of it. And said they just, a lot of them froze to death and chilled down, and some of them froze to death standing up. And that snow would just drift up on them, and they'd just leave them standing there. And they lost nearly all their cattle in that storm and the rest of the winter then. So they worked out a beef for Mr. Snover and said, well, you show us which one to butcher. And he said, it don't matter. Said, my brand is 7W. A 7 connected onto a W. Said, you just go on out and find one with my brand on it and it's yours. So they looked for a couple of days and found a big old fat cow with 7W on her and drove her up under a big old ponderosa pine where there's a good limb to hang her up on and shot her and was butchering her out and said, Mr. Snover come riding up. And he said, I'll declare, boys, you kill my milk cow. So my dad said that they'd cook cabbage, they'd get cabbage from him and cook that beef, and said when they went to seasoning those cabbage with that beef tallow and quit using that old keggy butter, how good that tasted to them. Well, that's the way the truth come into this country, and the Bible was then just as it is now. When you get married, it says only in the Lord. Now you can see what they had ahead of them. So,
Charles, who were your speakers? Who were your speakers, you know, that exhorted to come?
I think all three of the men, maybe two of the walkers, John and Charlie, and Joe Campbell and Ed Posey. Each one of them would kind of take turn about conducting the worship and saying a few words and kind of table talk, we would call it. Any questions? Thank you. All right. That first one you come to on your left there with the tin roof on it there, That was the Posey cabin. And then on down past my house, there was an old log cabin on the left. And later on, about, let's see, probably about 1900. No, it was before that. It was about 3 years after they come. So if there's 87, about 90, they all decided they'd build a schoolhouse. So they didn't float a bond. They just took their axes and their teams over there and cut the trees down and hewed out the logs and built a schoolhouse and hired a teacher and had school.
So is that where the meeting place
is? What?
Was that the first schoolhouse
there? Was one over on Bell Canyon just before that that they had built just with an old dirt floor and a little old shack type thing that wasn't really as good as what they wanted, so they built this one. And the other one was over there close to where you and Bobby lived, Jimmy, there in Mr. Ritchie's property right there somewhere. And I'm not sure just exactly where it was, but they said when they went to having school there that they had, I believe they had school 3 months in the summertime. Said the winters were too bad. They didn't have school in the winter. They had school 3 months in the summertime. Some little kids lived on about 8 miles in another canyon on down east of there. Two little twin boys in the first grade, and they had a teenage sister, and they would walk barefooted from there up there to school and back every day. And their name was Gwen, if you want to check into any history like that of any kind. Some more on down the 16 Springs named Steffi. They also walked from there, clear up there, to school. They had put the Indians on the reservation in 1872, and a lot of Indians had lived over in the area, 16 Springs area. When our folks came into that country, said a lot of the old Indian camps were still there, and a lot of their old tent poles and the places where they had set up their livelihood as such. Every few days, the Indian reservation was right across the ridge about 3 miles to the north of there in Elk Canyon. And there was an old Indian named Natsili. And the Indians then, rather than having one chief like Geronimo, the stories you all read about, they would kind of be like families, you know. Natsili had his little group there on Elk, and another one on up a little farther would have his, and then over around Mescalera, they had several. And then they would have rations, government rations, they called it, for the Indians every Tuesday. The old ones that weren't able to work and make their own living, men and women both, they'd call them in there, and they would cut off so much beef. They'd buy beef from everybody and give each one their rations, they called it. And the Indians would, that's the way they lived. The Indians were real, real poor people at that time. They'd put them on the reservation. But how were they going to make a living? So far, they just lived off the land, and they had all the land, and now they didn't have it all. So they was really poor people, and they really did steal a lot. And they stole a lot from our folks. But our folks said, we don't hold it against them. If anybody's that hungry, they've about got to steal to eat. And they made lots of good friends with the Indians. And several times when I was a youngster growing up, we would butcher beef and sell it around to the logging camps and different places. Even the stores, you know, in town, you could sell beef to anyone. The Indians would always come over there to get the guts, and they would, that's what they liked and what they wanted, and they would get them, put them in tow sacks. Sometimes you'd give them the head or something else, you know, that like that, and they'd eat them. And I never did see it, but our folks had told about those Indians eating those guts raw. Said they would just cut one and just go to chewing on it and eating the guts raw. And that's the truth. Yeah.
Who did your doctrine? When somebody was sick, you must have had some remedies come back to your family?
The government had a doctor over at Mescalera that was a kind of an army doctor, and he was one. And then There was a little later on, there wasn't any doctor around then besides that one at Mescalera that I ever heard him talk about. Later on, there was one that was down at Elk, and I don't remember his name, but there was a doctor down at a place here we called Elk, and that was quite a little settlement then, and the Cleves had a store there, a country store. They would go buy beans and sugar and things like that, the staples, and saddles, and harness, stuff like that that people had to have in those days. What?
Setting bullets and things like that, you just kind of did yourself.
You not broke a broken arm or...
I still didn't hear you. What about the...
Someone broke an arm or something?
Or they just split it up the best they could, and if anyone got sick, if they was able to make the trip, they'd take them to the doctor. If they wasn't, well, they'd just die. There was a fellow lived up here on James Canyon named Mosier, and he was coming down the road one day in his wagon, and then if you could kill a bear, you really had something, because that bear oil was more like lard. They didn't have any hogs then. They hadn't brought hogs into the country much yet. So they didn't have any lard, and they're seasoning everything with this beef tallow. But if you could kill a bear, this bear fat is kind of like oil, and it's real good to cook with. You ladies can make pie crust that'll just melt in your mouth out of bear grease. So Mr. Mosier looked up on the hill and he saw a big bear, and he shot that bear and went up there to get him, and he crippled him and said he's crippled pretty bad, so he decided that he'd try to drive him back down the canyon to the closer to the road so he wouldn't have to drag him. So he drove that bear back off down there and then shot him and killed him. And when he went up to his team then to catch his team and load the bear in his wagon and go, a horse is extremely afraid of a bear. I can assure you of that. Anyway, one of those horses kicked Mr. Mosier on the knee and broke his kneecap, busted his kneecap. And he said his knee swelled up big as your leg and said, oh, it's black as your hat. It sure did hurt. So he decided to ride his horse over to Mescalera to that old doctor. So he went over there to that old army doctor and he said, yeah, you've broken your kneecap. Nothing I can do. Go back home. So he rode back home and patched his kneecap up best he could. Several years ago, probably about maybe 40. Some Indians come driving into our house one time, and they weren't Apaches. They were Indians from some other tribe somewhere. We never had seen them before. So they was in an old car and had a bunch of kids, and they drove up there and stopped and said, we like to stay. My mother said, well, we'll give you some food and you can stay all night, but said, we can't keep you for long. Said, we'll do the best we can for you. And said, well, said, we'd like to stay. Said, we believe the Bible just like you. And she said, you do? Said, well, I didn't know there were any Indians that were Christadelphians. Said, oh, yeah, we. Said, what you say? Said, Christadelphians. Said, yeah, same thing. That's what we are. Said, well, I'll declare, said, come on in, said, she really was putting on the dog for him, you know, and said, directly, he said, oh, yeah, said, we think we're going to go to heaven when we die, all right, and she said, uh-oh, wait a minute, something's wrong here. So he's just pulling her leg, trying to get a hand out, so we fed them and bedded them down and sent them on their way the next day. Sure sleepy, huh? All right.